Welcome to Talk Dizzy to Me, the show that brings you a comprehensive look into the complex field of dizziness. Now here are your hosts, vestibular physical therapist Dr. Abby Ross and Dr. Danielle Tolman.
Welcome back to another episode of Talk Dizzy to Me. I'm Dr. Danielle Tolman, a vestibular physical therapist, and as always, joined by my co-host, Dr. Abby Ross, who's also a vestibular physical therapist and a neuroclinical specialist. Today, we have a very special episode that I am very excited about. We are joined by Dr. Lisa Farrell, who is going to help us talk about the connection in the mind-body connection managing dizziness. So, Lisa, would you mind just introducing yourself, giving us a little bit about your background and kicking us off here?
Absolutely. Well, just like you guys, I am a practicing physical therapist, and I also am a certified athletic trainer for about 35 years. Over the past 24 years, I've specialized in vestibular rehabilitation and have been solely treating adults with inner ear problems for that time. In addition to treating patients, I also teach. I teach in different capacities. I'm an adjunct clinical faculty member and guest lecturer at Nova Southeastern University. I also teach various postgraduate continuing education courses through my company, Symmetry Alliance. And I also had a really distinct honor to be a faculty member and one of the co-directors for many years at the American Physical Therapy Association's Vestibular Rehabilitation Competency-Based Course. And many people know that course as the EMRI course. Well, I had an incredible experience. I was there for over 20 years, and I just recently retired, and I'll explain why in a minute. I retired from the course, and I also retired from athletic training. I didn't renew my certification because I have other irons in the fire. So I'm not completely retired just from those two types of things that I was doing in the past, too many things on my plate. But I do want to, if it's okay with you and Abby and Danny, I do want to say that I had an incredible experience with the EMRI crew. The colleagues there, they are my mentors. They inspire me. People like Susan Herdman and Neil Shepherd and Susan Whitney and Rick Clendaniel. And I can go on and on. Rose Ryan, Jennifer Christie, Janine Holmberg. I don't want to leave anybody out because they're all incredible clinicians. And they've all done research and they treat patients. People like Michael Schubert, Tara Denham, Sheila Woodhouse, Jeffrey Hoder, Lisa Gillig. You guys know all these names. Courtney Hall, Laura Morris, Eric Anson, Carrie Hoppus. And there's Bridget Cook, an incredible clinician, and Wendy Schoenwald. These people inspire me, and I am the clinician I am today because of them.
Back in 2019, I was one of those nerds. You actually signed my vestibular rehab book for me. I have a nice textbook with your autograph in there after attending the course, because you are absolutely right. It is just absolutely amazing to be just in the same room with all of you who put that course on and teach us and further grow the profession. And we are, Abby and I are actually headed there to kind of hang out with Helena Esmond and her table at Vestibular First, just so that we can be again in the same room with everybody, because we missed it so much. We want to go back. And if you haven't taken the course and you're a clinician listening, you have to take it. You have to get on that wait list and get on there and register and be, in the midst of the greatest vestibuloholics out there. So amazing what you've done with that course, and just mind blowing.
I do want to say, Danny, I remember you sitting in front of me, and you're probably, because the faculty sit on the back row, you're probably going, shh, shh.
Well, I remember that the year before, the Rick Clendaniel had bought ear models from the model that I created for all the faculty members. And I remember sitting down in the lecture hall, trying not to nerd out and bring attention to myself because I know I can be a little bit much in those situations. And all I heard was the little rings rattle on one of the models behind me. And I believe it was you and Jennifer Braswell, Chrissy, who were sitting behind. And I just lost my mind and melted down in front of the two of you. And it was just the coolest experience. It kicked off, you know, with the first day of six of like Vestibuloholic summer camp. So it was amazing. You guys certainly have catapulted me into where I am now just with that experience, with that course alone. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you for all of the hard work you put into that. Yeah. It just goes so far. It's amazing. So now, post Emory courses, where is this? What is life looking like now?
Yeah. So after 20 years at Emory, I did make the decision to retire from the faculty position at Emory. And I just recently retired my athletic trainer certification, because I did this because I want to focus my efforts on offering mindfulness meditation instruction. And I'm also in the early stages of doing some clinical research in this area. So even though I continue to see patients and I'm teaching at the university and with other continuing education courses, I just couldn't do it all. And so now that kind of is a nice segue to talk to you about my mindfulness meditation journey. And it did begin with patients. About a decade ago, I started having patients, and I know you guys are going to shake your head, that these patients were more complex and more chronic in nature in terms of the conditions that they were having. And so I noticed there was a persistent challenge among this group. They had overwhelming emotions like anxiety, fear, sadness, frustration, right? Yes. Well, of course, these emotions hindered their progress with being able to relieve the dizziness, the vertigo, the unsteadiness that they came to see me about. Well, realizing the importance of addressing the emotional aspect, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but I can't also ignore that they can't do their exercises and they're overwhelmed and they're sitting in my office in tears sometimes, right? Well, I wanted to address this, but so I began teaching what I knew. I began integrating it into their treatment, breathing exercises, grounding exercises. And I didn't know it at the time, but I was teaching some aspects of mindfulness meditation. And patients responded positively to these exercises, and I took notice. Well, at the same time, I discovered mindfulness meditation for myself. And I was, at that time, so that was about 10 years ago, I was managing for myself a chronic pain condition, and it was impacting my life. Well, I really took to mindfulness meditation. I became a daily practitioner, and I continue to practice ever since. Well, recognizing that mindfulness meditation had potential to benefit my patients, I began to explore more into books and taking classes, and I made the decision to become a certified mindfulness meditation instructor. And the reason why I did that was because I wanted to be accurate with what I taught. I wanted to be helpful, but most of all, I didn't want to do any harm. I had excellent training, and I continue to grow in this area. And I use a mind and body approach now. It's an integral part of how I treat my patients, as well as how I care for myself. And so now when my patients come into follow-up visits, because every single patient has aspects of mindfulness, I meet them where they are. They are saying they're doing their exercises, they're improving with their symptoms, and their quality of life is better because they're more functional and more active. So at this point in time in my career, because I'm now on the downhill slide toward retirement, you know, within the next 10 years, I want to make sure the next generation learns not only about the things that I'm learning about the mind approach, the mindfulness meditation, but also taking what I learned from Emory from being a, having a PhD, the research that I've done and am doing, I really want the next generation to learn. So my efforts are going into that.
I love that. And I could not agree more that if you are a provider and you are not including this in your treatment plans, then you've got to change that ASAP. There is really one patient population that I think might be a unicorn that might not require this. And that's like a one and done BPPV, but it's rare, right? Because BPPV tends to recur. So speaking of specific diagnoses, you have, or there are a couple diagnoses where this is particularly important. And I would say that's vestibular migraine and 3PD. So can we dive a little bit more into your treatment approach for those two specifically?
And Abby, I do want to bring up, because I do follow you guys on social media, and I see it just sprinkled throughout almost every post that you, that I think a lot of people are already coming to the table, seeing, I hear it from therapists reaching out to me. I've taught multiple people. I have a 6-week mindfulness meditation course to teach people about mindfulness meditation and how to practice it. And so therapists have taken my course from me because they're interested in trying to incorporate that. But I see that also the way you guys post, it's now integral into your, whether it's mindfulness meditation or just behavioral aspects, addressing the behavioral aspects. So I think we are getting there. But to answer your question about a treatment approach for those with more chronic conditions, you're right. A one and done, or so to speak, BPPV that is a little bit more straightforward, or even sometimes a vestibular neuritis, something like that, where it's more structural in nature and it's not progressive or it's not lingering. Some, people actually compensate a bit easier. Then you're right. I don't get very many of those patients anymore, to be perfectly honest. Vestibular migraine is now makes up the majority of my caseload, and 3PD also, but definitely by far vestibular migraine. And because it is if we discuss the mechanism, the theories behind these conditions, we'll first talk about 3PD. It's thought of at this point in time that the body has been sensitized to normal movements that bring out their vestibular symptoms. So head turning, seeing visual stimuli, all of those things that are just normally when you see those things or do those things, they don't bring on symptoms. But because the body has a heightened awareness, they are more sensitive to that. Would you agree? And with that in mind, there is a very close relationship between that threat response or that threat system in our brains, as well as with anxiety. There are a lot of common connections. So it makes sense when people say, okay, when I first got dizzy, I was nervous about it. I was scared. Some people end up in the emergency room because they think they're having strokes. And that makes sense. The body's alerting you to say, hey, something's wrong. Pay attention. But when it continues on, and if you have a tendency to have a personality that's more anxious or hypervigilant, then it can set you up. We think this is the theory. It sets you up for your body to then just be sensitized to it. And if someone has, let's just say, for example, if they have more of a structural problem, like a vestibular neuritis, where the body does compensate. So acutely, they have their body alerts them that they should change their behavior, because they don't, if you don't change your behavior, you're dizzy, you might fall down, or and you maybe take shorter step lengths and you don't turn your head as much. That's what's supposed to happen acutely because you have a threat to your system. But those people that as the body starts to compensate and the problem resolves, I'm not saying that it goes back to normal. They could always have a weaker ear in that side that had the neuritis, but their body compensates for it. And so they actually end up then not being so sensitive to head motion or to visual stimulation. They can go back to having good balance where they can move, turn their heads quickly and move quickly and not have a problem. They're not no longer having to take short step lengths or having their wide space of support. That's what's supposed to happen as the body heals. But for some reason, those with 3PD, they have failure to adapt. It's like they get stuck in that sensitive mode. Anything you want to add to that that I'm missing?
I think it's being stuck in that mode too that feeds into that anxiety of, am I going to be like this the rest of my life? Is this ever going to change? Am I ever going to get everything back that I used to be able to do? And that's where you get into that dizzy, anxious, dizzy cycle where it kind of just continues to perpetuate into that. And that's very disturbing and very upsetting and isolating and depressing for people going through that as well. So you've got, again, that mind-body connection. You've got things where there's actual physiological responses going on due to this failure to adapt with the body. And then there's also just this added stress and worry on top of like, oh my gosh, this is life changing. And then there reaches a point where some patients are like, am I going crazy? Is this in my head? Am I manifesting this? No. And I think we get to that point where we really have to work with patients to show them that, nope, you're not crazy. This is not in your head. It's physically in your head. There's an actual physiological response happening that we need to learn how to adapt with and control and work on. So I think that's a really good point that you make.
And you're saying something very valid. Those that aren't necessarily have anxious personalities or are hypervigilant personalities, having a vestibular disorder, especially something that kind of goes on for a while, can make you anxious. And then there are those that do already come to the table. We see a lot of patients that say to us, you know, I've always been more anxious. I've always had been someone that has just been more sensitive in emotions. And so it only heightens that behavior because you are afraid of all the things you just talked about. Is it going to go away? Is my life changed? So we do things in physical therapy to try to help them be able to tolerate movement, tolerate visual scenes. It's a form of habituation, which is basically just desensitizing them. But we have to be a lot more careful, especially with the 3PD and the vestibular migraine population, with overstimulating them. That's on the physical side, but then there's also the mindset that they have. Do they believe that, even subconsciously, it may not even be totally conscious, it's just something that's either, again, reinforced because of their coming to the table with a certain personality that is more anxious, and they tend to ruminate, meaning they worry about things that may possibly happen, or catastrophize, where they think that the worst possible thing is going to happen. And so mindset also matters. So we could be providing very gentle exercises that are just stimulating them just enough to help them get better, to be effective to help them get better. But I also find that how they come to the table with their mindset also really matters.
Mindset, I think, is huge. And even if you don't realize you're talking about mindset, anytime as a provider, you're educating a patient on what to expect, whether it's you will feel symptoms, you will have regressions at some point, good days and bad days are expected. just setting them up for the proper expectations already is formulating their mindset into a more positive and responsive setting, I guess I would say. I think mindset is so powerful. And when you talk back with patients that you've helped in the past, like I keep in touch with a lot of patients, they'll send me emails and update me. And they often will say, you said something back then, and it has nothing to do with the standard vestibular exercise that I gave. It was something that came out of my mouth that changed the way that they thought about the situation.
You make a very good point that as physical therapists, we get a chance to educate. That's, I think education is so much power. The more you educate them, that's absolutely what we've had in our tool bag forever, that we get to spend the time, that we have the time to educate. Now we're learning also beyond education, the mindset really does matter. That one, you've told them that, yes, me explaining like I did about the theory as to why people have 3PD and they didn't heal, that really is helpful. But then we go to the next level and utilize that theory to help them get better. We utilize the theory of, okay, their body's not adapting physically. Let's help them to tolerate motion, tolerate visual scenes so that they can increase their ability to tolerate. And we use habituation exercises. And I always am surprised though, and tell me if this has been your experience, that people who have gone to therapy for a long time, they're like, well, it just made me worse. It just made me so much worse. And it typically was because they weren't gentle enough. They overdid it. And I find, especially when your body is not adapting, you need to have it. Sometimes I'll even say we want to have positive reinforcement. So let's find, instead of habituation, typically is where we try to bring on symptoms, right? We're trying to, so that they can, their body can adapt over time and so that they don't feel the symptoms very much. But in the world of concussion, I'm going to use that as an analogy. They have headache a lot of times because they can't tolerate exertion. And instead of just saying, okay, well, let's go ahead and have them exert themselves either with mental work, you know, schoolwork, regular working on a computer, or physical exertion, we don't allow them to go into headache. We say, okay, well, let's stay below that threshold. Well, I find that actually has been very, very helpful for me with 3PD and vestibular migraine is if when I do physical exercise, sometimes I'll utilize activity, but they find that threshold where it actually brings on their symptom and then they work below that threshold. Do you guys do that sometimes too? Oh,
absolutely. But there's usually a whole amount of time that I take to sit down with the patient and really talk about the home exercise program and the role of therapy and that program to get them feeling better. So I use something called the rule of five, where it's completely based on every patient's own scale, but 10 out of 10 being the worst your symptoms have ever been, zero meaning completely no symptoms. And you never want your symptoms to exceed a 5 out of 10. So you want to stir the pot. A 2 or 3 is great. A 4 out of 10 is your warning sign. And as soon as you hit 5, no matter what you're doing on that exercise, you stop. You wait for things to go back to baseline before you can pick up and continue later on in the day. We talk about that there's going to be days where you hit 5 quickly and you need to give yourself a break. And there's days where you can hover underneath that for longer amounts of time, doing more activities. And those are great days. But not one day is going to look the same. You have to give yourself grace on the days that are a little bit more symptom provoking. And we just need to realize that this isn't a no pain, no gain situation. If you go in too hard, too fast, too soon, you're going to push yourself in the wrong direction. And then we have to look at the dosing of all of our exercises and rethink all of that. I think that not enough people in this specialty who are starting out and trying to fill in all 45 of those minutes for their 3-unit slot are taking that into consideration with those patients. And that's why maybe some people have a very hard time tolerating vestibular therapy at first, especially if they have this maladaptation and issue with persistent and chronic symptoms. So there, you are speaking our language. We're in total agreement with you on that one.
So I love the fact that you help them to have ownership. So you gave them a kind of a window of tolerance to say, one, this is what is okay to tolerate, but you also help them to be mindful. You gave them multiple opportunities to be aware. Where am I right now? The additional piece, so there's awareness and mindfulness. That's part of the aspect of being mindful, is simply being aware. But the other part with being mindful is, how are you reacting to that awareness? So you gave them a little bit of guidance. It's okay to be, this 5 is okay. You're not injuring yourself. You probably even say that in your own way. You are helping yourself, and especially with those that have structural problems. And a structural problem is someone who has a neuritis, or they've had acoustic neuroma surgery where they had a tumor taken out and they end up with an asymmetry between their ears. So they have dizziness because of that. As they are compensating those structural problems, they can tolerate those 5 so much better. One, because the 5 will be there and then it goes away. And we always say, you know, it should go away within 20 to 30 minutes at the most, that 5. You should be back down to baseline. That's with our structural problems. But those with 3PD and vestibular migraine, a lot of times, especially with 3PD, their symptoms, they do an activity, it starts here. And then they do another activity, it just starts to pancake and accumulate over time. And they just never get back down to that baseline. And those are the patients a lot of times, so that, again, just like there's operant conditioning, in operant conditioning with B.F. Skinner back in your high school days, if you remember, or college, you learned about how we learn things. Behaviors are learned either through reward or through punishment. We tend to stay away from the things that punish us. And we tend to do more of the things that reward us. So I have that same idea, especially with a migraine brain or a brain that has 3PD that doesn't adapt real well. Let's give them a lot of reward, meaning stay under that threshold so that they can see that, hey, this is not a threat to my body. And now, because I'm doing this activity, I have the opportunity to adapt. And I say those things to them saying, and you need to talk to yourself like that. You need to say, okay, I'm paying attention to how I feel, but not only am I paying attention, it's how I'm paying attention. This is good for me. I'm taking care of myself. This is only temporary. They use these same phrases in pain when people have painful conditions. So it's basically allowing us to utilize our minds and have a mindset that promotes a way of conditioning that's healthy for us, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So on the flip side of this, sometimes we have patients that come to us who are what I would say hypervigilant. They are overly touching base with their body, and every second, every small change they're aware of. So I wonder if you could give our audience some tips on what to do in those moments. So you're supposed to be aware of what's happening with your body. But let's say you're aware, you also mentioned it's important how you react. What is an appropriate response once you're aware that symptoms are changing?
that can, those are the toughest clients in this, and it's not a bad thing. It's just sometimes they need, you know, mindfulness meditation is not a cure-all. It's a tool. But that tool can be used in the case of people that are hypervigilant. I talked to them about, you know, when, as we, I had a patient just this yesterday, where she does tend to catastrophize, where everything is still just happening as if, and she has to tell you every detail. She's just, like you said, hypervigilant. So first of all, I just make her aware. I said, I have to make her aware. She may not even be aware. And I try to do it in a very gentle and kind manner. It's not a critical or judgmental manner. It's simply, let's start being aware of how you're handling situations. But what I can also do is simply teach her where, again, that's more on an intellectual level, but I can start outside of her exercises, outside of the rehab part, have her do things where she is simply being mindful, like a mindful moment. Have you guys ever done a mindful moment? Are you familiar? Because mindful moments allow us to engage fully in the present moment. And you can be mindful of your breath. You can be mindful of your body. You can be mindful. So those are internal experiences. They're happening in the present moment, because the definition of mindfulness meditation, because I haven't really given it completely, I've alluded to it, is basically it's the formal practice of mindful meditation is where you're simply paying attention to the present moment experience on purpose. And you're doing it with a particular attitude, in a particular way. You're doing it without judgment, with curiosity, and with kindness. So it's a gentle awareness. So that's where, if you take apart that definition and you just look at it in two parts, there's two essential elements of mindfulness meditation is, one, you're paying attention. And with formal practice, you need to train your attention, because most of the time, our attention is not where it wants to be, where we want it to be. Research has shown that over 60% of the time, we're not have our attention where we want to be, where we want it to be. But that's just one aspect of mindfulness meditation. The other aspect is having that particular attitude, that attitude of being not judgmental. And you have to cultivate that behavior, because a lot of times we have clouded and limited ways of thinking that are not productive, where we say this should be happening and I want this to happen. And when it's in reality just not happening, there has to be some level of fostering acceptance of the moment. So going back to your question about those patients that tend to just be hypervigilant, they can't let go outside of their therapy. If they're doing little mindful, brief mindful exercises to get them started, and that's how I introduce mindfulness in my patient care, is to give a mindful moment. And we can take a mindful moment right now so people can experience it if you want. Please. And like I said, we're going to use the breath. And when I teach a mindful moment, I may start the therapy session not saying, well, let's do a mindful moment, because people have a lot of misconceptions about mindfulness meditation. You know, they're sometimes threatened by it because they really don't know what it is. So I'll simply just say, you know, let's take a moment. We were busy before we came here. We were in traffic. I was working with another patient, so that we can truly just be right here, right now. I want you to do this exercise with me. So I'm going to invite you both, if you want, and whoever's listening, When they watch this podcast, you can do this if you choose. And it literally is just a minute. So it's quite nice. But I'm going to invite you either to close your eyes if you feel comfortable, or if you prefer, you can gaze softly toward the floor so that you're not staring at anything in particular, just allowing your eyes to rest. And then I'm going to have you take a long, slow, full, deep breath in and out. The out breath be longer than the in breath. And with your next breath, allow your breath to return to its natural rhythm, its natural depth. Simply follow the inhale and exhale in and out. You may feel movement. You may have different sensations. That's the experience. You're not thinking about the breath, you're experiencing it. And that's a mindful breath. Now your mind will get caught up and be distracted. It happens to everyone because the job of the mind is to think. So you'll get distracted, and that's okay. When you notice that, you're simply going to come back to mindful breathing. And I'm going to go ahead and follow, I'll let you continue mindful breathing, and I'll keep track of the time for 1 minute. Now I invite you to slowly open your eyes if they were closed and ask yourself how you feel in this moment. And also I invite you to savor, to appreciate that you've taken some time to care for yourself. And then I'll have a conversation with patients about that, because especially with those that the breath can be actually really disconcerting. They try too hard. We breathe all day long without thinking about it. But I've had patients, I've had clients that couldn't tolerate the breath. So there's mindful moments where we pay attention to the body. You know, the soles of the feet, your bottom on the seat, your hands. Pay attention to a sound. If you notice, though, in that mindful moment, I didn't ask you to relax. But either of you, what was your experience with that mindful moment?
I always feel very light and floaty. I can kind of sit back into my breath and kind of feel it get deeper in that moment, listening to everything that's going on. And then by the time you kind of bring awareness back and kind of bring us back up to being aware and kind of coming back to just this normal existence, I do feel very relaxed, very floaty is definitely a word, which might be alarming to some when they have vestibular dysfunction, right? Like floaty is not something that they want to be, but I feel lighter in that sense.
Exactly. And you're absolutely right. Floating can be very disorienting to some people, but I like the fact that you said, I feel relaxed. What about you, Abby?
I'm glad you brought up distraction, because sometimes I actually educate patients to lean into the distraction. So when I'm completely silent like that with my eyes closed, my other senses heighten. I can hear you know, the smallest of things that may take away from my breath, but guess what else it's taking away from? The ruminating thought or the negative thought. I'm now, my mindset has, or my focus has shifted to something that's not as threatening, like the sound that I'm hearing. I also, and I learned this through my own meditation practice, but I also like in those moments to touch base with a part of my body that feels best, whether it's most relaxed or least dizzy, whatever it is. And it can be something silly like the tip of my nose or a fingernail or a toe or something, you know, something.
I love it.
Yeah. It's
all touching on mindfulness meditation because you're bringing awareness. And interesting, you use the word distraction. Distraction is something that comes into your mind because you weren't planning on it being there. So when we give patients activities that we use, this is to distract you. No. It's not distracting them. It's a choice. They're making a choice to pay attention to something else. Like you said, Abby, it's there. You're saying, I choose. That's what you're training with formal meditation is I'm choosing to place my attention on my breath, on a body part, on someone's voice.
But I like that.
Because it's not a distraction. A distraction is something that just kind of all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I'm on this podcast, but I just remembered that I forgot to turn off the oven, you know, and what happens? Oh no. Is something going to go wrong? You know, did I leave it on? And is what I put in the oven going to overcook? That's a distraction. It just randomly comes into your mind. It takes you away from what you're presently doing.
That's good. I'm going to change that to be mindful because you are mindfully choosing what it is that you're shifting your focus toward. When I interview patients in the patient history portion of an evaluation, one of the things I always ask is, what makes you feel better? And the amount of times that people say, well, when I'm distracted, like when I'm out with my friends, I don't feel it as much. But I like that change in verbiage to now say that you're mindfully choosing to focus on something else.
And that's emotion regulation. You are monitoring, you are then choosing to have a behavior that is productive, is skillful, and then you're letting go because in meditation, we're training in awareness. We're training to pay attention to something in the present moment, like the breath, the body, sound. There's meditations where you go walking and you pay attention to, it's called, there's a five sense meditation or mindfulness meditation where you pay attention to five different things in the environment. So you look around and you see things. You don't tell yourself stories about them. You simply see it, experience it, observe it. Then once you've done that, like you said, Abby, sometimes you have people actually pause even in your meditation. If something does distract you, catches your attention and your mind wanders, but you go, okay, I'm going to acknowledge that. That's what we do. And then we bring ourselves back to what we were paying attention to. Well, the same thing with this five senses walking meditation, or you can do it standing, you can do it sitting. But a lot of times I'll do a mindful walk and I'll pay attention to five different things. I'll see five different things. And then I'll move on to four things that I feel. My feet hitting the ground, the clothes on my skin, the temperature, the swinging of my arms. Then I'll pay attention to three things that I hear. And you can take your time to do these, pay attention to these different things. You don't have to do them real rapidly. The thing that you're trying to avoid is going down the rabbit hole of thinking. You're trying to experience the senses. And then after three things I hear, two things that I smell. Now, smell is very fleeting, and sometimes we smell nothing, but that is something. acknowledge that. The same thing then with taste. If I'm not eating or drinking something because I'm taking a walk, you know, do I taste anything in my mouth? Again, whatever is there is what's actually happening. So it may not be, I have no taste in my mouth, or maybe, you know, I do something, you know, a smell came by, and sometimes smell allows us to kind of also taste something. So my point is, there's so many ways to be mindful, and outside of your exercises, now you can incorporate before and after your physical exercises, again, just so that you can simply be present without judgment. If you notice in that mindful moment, I said thoughts are going to come and they're going to go. I didn't say they shouldn't be there. I didn't say you need to want them to go away. That's judging. No, you simply, that's reality. That's awareness. That's being aware of what's happening in the moment. And you go, oh, okay, thinking, or oh, okay, feeling. And then you simply let that go and you come back to focusing on the object that you're intending to focus on. And in the case where the breath, you come back to the breath. But the thing about it is, just like we want to strengthen our biceps and do bicep curls so we can lift up a heavy object so that we don't hurt ourselves, we don't hurt the muscle, we don't hurt our back, we have to do lots of repetitions.
I wanted to touch on that because I wanted to focus yes. on these words that keep coming up, like practice and training, because this is something that I think without having your own personal experience, it can be difficult to tell your patients to go meditate or go do this or go do that. And you can't kind of, you know, talk about that. And I only, you know, got into this because of the Emory course and a lecture that Janine Holmberg gave on triple PD and her actual experience going through that and how much mindfulness and meditation really made a difference in her approach when it came to feeling better. And then diving into these own guided meditation apps like Insight Timer or Calm, and then going through your mindfulness meetups, which we will link in the show notes because all of you should be doing these meetups and learning from these amazing, amazing time together. But talk a little bit about what that looks like in terms of practice and training. Will people see a result the first day that they try this, or is it something that takes time?
Well, actually, there has been research to show. So two things. I have had experience because there's so many misconceptions that I do highly recommend that people do get training, because there's so many things like, oh, I'm you know, mindfulness is about relaxation. Well, that is one, I won't touch on all the misconceptions, but that is one of the biggest ones is mindfulness is, the goal isn't relaxation. The goal is to welcome everything so that we can have a better handle on how we perceive things that are happening in our lives. You don't want a police officer to practice mindfulness meditation so that he can be so relaxed when he is trying. He needs to be hyper vigilant so that the bad guys don't shoot him and he doesn't shoot the bad guy. You want him to be alert, but you want him to have a clarity of alertness. You want him to have a skillful way of being aware. So in terms of relaxation, you'll have moments of relaxation, but not all thoughts, if we're welcoming everything, not all thoughts, not all sensations will be relaxing. But that is our experience in that moment, and how you perceive it, how you handle it, takes training. So I highly recommend people get training, because they have misconceptions, like they think, oh, you know, I'm going to meditate before bed so I can relax and go to sleep. Well, what they're really probably doing is, they might be being mindful, but they're not formally meditating. They're doing a relaxation exercise, and good on them. That works. But at the same time, there's other misconceptions. Like they think that if they have strong spiritual beliefs and that they'll have to change, that it's required that they'll have to change the way they believe in things, because the mindfulness meditation has a history of being it from 2,500 years ago, 2,500 years ago or more. It's more of an Eastern tradition. All religious traditions typically have a contemplative practice like mindfulness meditation, but the two are completely independent. They, as you can see, I'm not talked anything about spirituality. I'm talking about awareness. And so people have misconceptions about what it really is. I don't have enough time to do it. I have to clear my mind, right? These are all misconceptions. So I highly recommend that people get training so that they have success with it. I have had multiple people, including family members, that I'm like, they didn't really want to take a course. So I'm like, well, okay, do one of these apps. And they crashed and burned. They're like, it's not for me. But it really was, again, just maybe they just didn't have a real understanding, or they came up with some challenges and they didn't know how to get around it. Something is every time I started to meditate, I fell asleep. You know, how do I deal with that? So taking a class is really, really important. Did I answer your question ultimately?
There's a lot more to it than just hopping on an app or closing your eyes and saying om, which I think a lot of people get into this. You know, they look at me like I'm crazy and I'm saying, we need to start looking into this as part of your rehab, as part of your treatment pie, as Abby likes to refer to it. So yes, I think that finding some more formal training and education behind what the practice is like and how to be successful with it is very important. So say, as a clinician, and I want to refer patients to finding that, can we refer, or how to refer, and do you have some resources for us that we can recommend to our patients?
Yes. So I have a couple of different things. I really feel like we can get started as clinicians. You guys already are. You're already coming to the table utilizing, whether or not, like, I really didn't even know that I was using some aspects of mindfulness meditation. So we're already coming, you know, giving our patients a lot of these ideas and really in a great way too. But there are times when people do need to go, like you said, beyond just taking an app and using it. And some people, when I first started, I actually started with Headspace, and I really took to it. I was hungry for it, and I started taking classes and reading books and stuff, and I've just grown and grown and continue to grow in my practice. It's a journey. But then you have to be cautious with recommending that, because, like I said, if they try it on their own and they are not successful, maybe it's not because it doesn't work. It's just they may need to have a qualified meditation instructor do it. Now, I do teach online a live class. It's a 6-week class. That's an opportunity. I teach people all over the nation, from Canada also, and even I have a client right now in Israel. But I will say that we have to be careful, just like with vestibular rehab, competency in vestibular rehab and competency with mindfulness meditation instructors. There is no ultimate governing body. I do use the word certified mindfulness meditation teacher because I really did have really good training, and I look outside of that and I see that I am following what is the, and I do research. In fact, I'm trying to develop a research study with a doctoral student, and we're going to be using it with mindfulness meditation with vestibular rehabilitation. So I know I've had good training, but just to help qualify me, I use that terminology of I'm certified, because that's what I've been told that I have. But there is no governing body, so you do have to be careful. Buyer beware. But even also not, I know to turn away some of my clients, that there's no real way for me to I have been surprised a couple times, even after interviewing my clients, to make sure that they don't have overwhelming anxiety, that they aren't in a deep depression, or they've had some sort of significant trauma. So even with myself as a mindfulness meditation instructor, I have to be careful that I'm not always the right person for the job because I don't have psychological training. And there are a lot of psychologists that are also mindfulness meditation instructors. It's just, you have to seek it out. So did that help you answer the question?
Absolutely. And I want to put your website up here. Everything's going to be in the show notes as well, as to where everybody can find you and your amazing courses. Again, I want to shout out those mindfulness meetups. We just attended your mindfulness meetup for February, and it's absolutely amazing. It was the perfect break I needed in my day to kind of reset and kind of bring awareness and focus back into all the chaos that goes on in life. And we are just so grateful for all the wonderful information and resources you brought, especially with your Mindful Minute. I'm really excited for people to listen and to take something away from this episode immediately, and where to go from there. So again, we're so appreciative, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Can I add, just, we didn't really talk about vestibular migraine.
Yeah, add everything you like.
So I do want to say that, just like with a chronic condition like 3PD, and my practice is definitely going toward seeing a lot of patients that have vestibular migraine, and we used to think, okay, they come with dizziness and vertigo, well, let's just do habituation exercises, but it's an irritative lesion, and we now also, research is showing more and more that you use vestibular rehabilitation in conjunction with reducing the migraine. And even if, so migraine is more than a headache. So a lot of times our patients come to us saying, I don't have headache, you know, right? And then we have to convince them that, you know, it's vestibular migraine. But even those that are convinced, we know that they need to have adequate management because they have of their migraine, of because their brains, we think due to genetics mostly, is just hyper excitable. It also doesn't adapt. It wants to always have, our brains tend to always want to have balance, what's called homeostasis, you know, the fancy word for that. And most of the time when our brains go out of balance, meaning we don't get enough sleep, or we eat chocolate, or there is stressful situations. we can't always reduce stress, meaning if there's been a loss of a job or a loss of someone in your life in whatever capacity, if you have a chronic condition, a loss of the life that you had before this condition began, you don't try to reduce stress. It's how you perceive the stress. So we, as physical therapists, we do go ahead and help. We can be a great deal of help in helping manage that migraine, that brain that doesn't adapt well, that's hyper excitable, that wants to stay in balance, but doesn't tolerate being out of balance. And we can help them manage their migraine through lifestyle behavior strategies. And I utilize the acronym SEEDS. You guys are familiar with SEEDS. And you can find a handout also that I put together on my website. I have a whole page on complimentary resources of valuable handouts, and that's one of them that explains SEEDS. SEEDS is basically, it stands for these lifestyle behavioral strategies that you can work on, is sleep, exercise, eating, drinking, and stress management. And that's where the mind-body part comes in. So a lot of people come to the table already saying, well, I'm hydrating and I do exercise, but probably across the board, and you guys are going to agree with me, I know, is that it's the stress management. It's also a lot of times the sleep, but sleep could be some of it's just situational, meaning maybe they're in a time in their life, their hormones are not as good, so they don't sleep as well as they used to. But also, it's if you are having unpleasant discomfort a lot during the day, it doesn't just turn off at night. And so that's harder to go to sleep. Then you add on top of that the emotional aspect of it, the anxiety, the sadness, the frustration. It's hard to get good quality sleep. So you can see where actually meditating during the day actually helps you sleep better at night. So I did bring it around full circle. So even with those chronic conditions of vestibular migraine, where we're working on lifestyle behaviors and helping them manage that, because medications do not, they're not expected to completely take care of migraines. And most of my patients, they don't even want to be on medications.
So ditto, we see the same thing.
Yeah. So we have to help them out with those behaviors. So thank you for letting me talk about that too. I didn't want to leave out that patient population.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us. Audience, we'll be sure to link resources, including her website and where you can find her 6-week mindfulness meditation course. I might even be taking it myself because I think I could benefit. So thank you all for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
This podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition.
The content of this podcast is based on general knowledge and information available up until the recording of this specific episode. Medical knowledge and practices may evolve over time, and new information may emerge that could change the understanding or treatment of vestibular dysfunction. It is important to consult a qualified healthcare professional for the most up-to-date and personalized advice.
The information provided in this podcast is meant to complement, not replace, the relationship that exists between a patient and their healthcare provider. It is intended to empower patients with knowledge about vestibular dysfunction and its management, but individual cases may vary and treatment approaches should be tailored to each patient's unique circumstances.
By listening to this podcast, you acknowledge and agree to the terms of this medical disclaimer. The organizers, presenters, and creators of this podcast are not liable for any actions or decisions taken by individuals based on the information presented herein. Always consult with a qualified healthcare provider for medical advice and treatment.